From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Twenty-one years ago, Jody Arlington's teenage brother murdered her parents and sister and nearly killed her. On today's Fresh Air, Arlington tells her story. It's one she hadn't spoken about publicly, but the recent news of an 18-year-old Ohio boy who killed the members of his family, except for a sister who survived, prompted Arlington to write an op-ed piece in the Washington Post. She says it's worth looking into the abyss to get a better understanding of how such tragedies can be prevented. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews the new book, People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music by Robert Darden. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In late May, in rural Ohio, an 18-year-old boy named Scott Moody shot four members of his family and two other people, then shot himself. There was only one survivor, his sister Stacy. When my guest Jody Arlington read the news story, she could barely breathe. It was so close to her own story. 21 years ago, when Arlington was 16, her 18-year-old brother killed their parents and little sister. But unlike the Moody story, Arlington's brother spared her life and his own. In June, Arlington wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, in which, for the first time, she shared her story in a public way. She wrote, quote, "In the aftermath of a parricide, a child's murder of one or more parents, most of the attention focuses on the killer and the deceased parents. Little, if any, attention falls to any siblings who may have been left behind. I knew that only a handful of people, myself among them, could shed light on some of the daunting challenges Stacy may face if she survives her physical wounds," unquote. By the way, Stacy Moody has survived. Jody Arlington went on to write, quote, "Nearly almost every day in the U.S., a child kills his or her parent and sometimes the whole family. In most cases, the murderer is a white male who has been severely abused, can no longer tolerate life at home, and has no trusted adult to whom he can turn," unquote. Those conditions pretty well describe Arlington's brother, who is still in prison. In retrospect, she believes her brother showed plenty of warning signs. She thinks it's worth looking into the abyss to get a greater understanding of how to prevent such tragedies. We invited Arlington to talk about her life, starting with what happened the day of the murders.
I was upstairs in my bedroom sleeping, and Billy, you know, began killing everyone downstairs. He brought my sister upstairs and told her to stay there, and she didn't. She went back downstairs, and he then killed her too. And it was when she started screaming that I realized that something terrible was happening. And, you know, he had kind of joked about killing our parents in the past and had, you know, had some issues the day before, and I just put two and two together and realized what had happened and thought that I was going to be next. But when he came upstairs covered in blood, he did not have the weapon, the baseball bat, with him, and just started saying things like, "I'm not crazy. Do you think I'm crazy? It was so much bloodier than I ever thought it would be." And I just kind of couldn't believe that it was happening. I was in shock and had always kind of escaped from a lot of the problems in our family in books, and just told myself that this was happening. It was just make-believe, it wasn't real, it was in a story, and I just had to be the character in the book who figured out how to escape and call the police and all of those things, and that's what I did.
What did you do after he came in your room and you realized he'd killed your family?
I basically did the same thing that they tell hostages to do, to kind of go along with the situation, or like when someone robs you and they say, "Give you the wallet." I behaved in that way and just went along with everything he said until I could find an opportunity to call the police, which I did. We went to a neighbor's house because he wanted to go out, and I, at that time, was able to call the police, and they picked him up a few hours later, and then it was it.
Had he showered and washed the blood off before going to the neighbor's house?
He did wipe down in the bathroom before going, before we went over to the neighbor's.
So you just instinctively knew to do that, to play along until there was a safe moment?
Well, it was just so shocking and so numbing, I didn't know what to do. But somehow in my mind, I just knew that I had to go along with everything and find an opportunity to call the police. And, you know, when I went downstairs and, you know, he was in the bathroom wiping the blood off of him, I thought that it was a joke that he and my sister had pulled on me, because I could hear my father snoring in the living room. And, you know, and I saw, you know, Becky kind of lying on the ground, but there was no visible blood or anything like that. And I was just like, oh my God, this is the most terrible practical joke ever, and I can't believe they did that. But then as I started listening to my father snoring, it was actually this really terrifying gurgling sound. And at that point, I realized that it obviously wasn't a joke. And I started, you know, when they describe, you know, losing all the blood and getting cold and numbing and all of that stuff, and basically all the body's reactions before you faint, I started feeling those things. And then I heard my sister moan and realized that she was still alive. And I started to exclaim, "Becky's still alive." And obviously I couldn't say that because he would then kill her. And so I just, it just kind of renewed my ability to keep it all together so that I could get her an ambulance. I found out afterwards that she never had a chance at all, that that he had hit her with such force that she'd never had a chance. But at the time, that's what kept me together.
Did you think that there was still a chance that your brother was going to kill you too?
I did. And in fact, when we went to the neighbors and I went inside to, he had wanted to go out. And so my plan was like, okay, we will go somewhere and I will slip away to the bathroom and call the police. And he was waiting in the car and I was going to go and get this neighbor who was a friend of mine from school. And I went upstairs to the neighbor and considered as I was there, it's like, do I tell her what happened? Or, you know, or do I, you know, just keep with my original plan of waiting until we were out in public? And it just occurred to me that there was just no way that she would be able to, would believe me, would be able to keep it together or do anything to kind of keep me from having endangered her entire family as well. So I didn't tell her. And she said, you know, come up here a little while and we'll, you know, we'll just kind of hang out a little bit. And so I went downstairs and the phone was, you know, in the hallway between her bedroom and the outdoors. And I thought, you know, do I call now? And, you know, I just decided no, because if I call, then the police will come and he will be here and I will have endangered this entire other family. And that's not going to work. So I didn't call. And when I opened, they had a porch. And when I opened the door to the porch, rather than Billy waiting in the car, he basically had his ear to the door behind the kitchen. And, you know, had he heard me, you know, calling the police or whatever, you know, I don't know if he would have come in and killed me or if he would have ran off. I don't know. But, you know, clearly he was listening in for something. So anyway, he shortly thereafter went to get cigarettes. And as soon as I saw him pull out of the house, I called the police and they found him and arrested him.
One of the things that your brother said to you was, "We're free," meaning you're now free of your parents. Do you think he thought that you were going to be on his side?
Absolutely, he thought that. And, you know, he was wrong. We did live in a, you know, a very abusive family situation. And while there weren't any, like, imminent, like, physical abuses pending or anything like that, it was a really difficult home life. And I think that he thought that I would approve and wanted my approval.
Had you been abused by your parents?
Not so much physically as psychologically and emotionally. They were poorly educated and religious fundamentalists and did not have a lot of control over their own lives. We kind of had this toxic combination of failing finances. My parents' relationship with each other was failing. My brother had been in trouble with the law in school so much that you know, his problems exacerbated kind of the whole family unit's issues. And they really inflicted a kind of strange psychological abuse. I can't really describe it.
Do you think that your brother thought at any point that what he did was to protect you? You know,
he's gone on record that that's what he thought that he was doing, and that, yeah, I mean, that's what he's claimed was his rationale for it. I think there was a great deal of anger and fear and rage, and I mean, he was diagnosed as a sociopath after the murders, and he kind of had a long record where he had been increasingly violent and had arson and theft, and you know, he was physically abusive too in the household. And you know, in addition to my parents' failings as, you know, custodians of us children, they also were in grave denial about him and the problems he was causing in the family. And they distrusted the police and schools and kind of doctors and anyone who would kind of say that there was a serious problem.
You mentioned that, you know, there were records that were found from what, teachers and doctors, basically spelling out some of the problems that he had. Was that advice ignored?
You know, I think that it was partially ignored, and I think partially that my parents had just given up and didn't believe it. I don't really know. I know that at one point my mother had asked me, you know, this is after he had been in a juvenile detention home or something like that. She said, you know, we have a choice now of having Billy come back and be at home with us, or to go to, you know, a juvenile detention home for a year or something like that. And she asked me what I thought would be best. And I told her that I thought that he should go somewhere, that his behavior was, you know, getting worse and they couldn't do anything about it. And you know, that was my contribution, but they didn't do that. He came back home.
My guest is Jody Arlington. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jody Arlington. 21 years ago, her 18-year-old brother killed their parents and younger sister. We're talking about the murders and what her life has been like since then. You were the sole witness at the trial, so you had to testify against your brother.
Yes.
Was your impulse to protect him or to try to get him behind bars in prison?
My impulse at the time was to do what, you know, I was told to do, and you know, my attorneys and the prosecution said, you know, only answer the questions that are asked, and you know, don't offer any information. And you know, I wasn't in the trial at all until it was my time to testify. And I think it was like 7 minutes or something like that. And it wasn't until years later, when I was trying to figure out what had happened and how I felt about it, that I got a copy of the trial transcript and realized that there had been no detailing anywhere in the trial about the kind of abuse that had been in our family, and that I had even downplayed it a little bit in my testimony. And so I, you know, I felt very badly about that. And so in, I guess, 2000, as part of, you know, his ongoing efforts to get out, he saw it, and I provided an affidavit that attested to the fact that there was family abuse, and that would be necessary to be presented for him to have a fair trial, and that I would support that. But I also said in that affidavit that doesn't mean that I think he should necessarily have a lesser sentence, or that he would be necessarily, you know, able to function in society just because of his long, you know, his record and kind of his behavior beforehand. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know if you can unbecome a sociopath, but, you know, that's kind of my understanding of his case.
Your brother was convicted of 3 counts of aggravated murder for killing your parents and your sister. He was given 3 consecutive life sentences. Have you visited him in prison? Do you have contact with him anymore? And what's it been like deciding, like, what your relationship to him should be?
I have not visited him in prison, and and don't plan to. In the early 90s, I wrote to him because our paternal grandmother really wanted to understand what had happened and why he had done it. And she told me, you know, I don't want to die hating him. And I didn't want to get into a conversation with her about what went was going wrong in the family and things like that. And so I wrote to him saying that she didn't want to die hating him and that, you know, she wants to understand why he did it and would he please write to her. And at that time, I got a letter back that was really written more to a parole board than to me. It was kind of what's known as your kind of typical convict letter that's just not really personal or real. And, you know, he continued writing quite a few letters, actually, and I don't want to have a relationship with him and have no plans to do so.
You know, in the op-ed that you wrote, you said that that you had to deal with a lot of guilt, and you think that survivors of family murders like this have to deal with a feeling of guilt. About what? I mean, you're not the one who killed your parents and sister. Your brother did that. What do you have to feel guilty about?
Well, basically, anytime you're a sole survivor, I mean, it's called survivor's guilt, and there's plenty of you know, literature on it. It's just you feel guilty. It's like, why me? Why didn't I die? Or, you know, what could I have done differently? Or, you know, what could I have said or done to prevent this or change the outcome? And you just go through, like, all the different things that you may have done differently. Obviously, because, you know, Billy has claimed that he was protecting me or that, you know, he thought, and because he thought that I was somehow, you know, supportive of what he was doing, you know, it just increases that. It's like, what did I say and do to make him think that? And could I have said or done something to make him not? And, you know, and I go through like everything that happened that day and like what would have happened if I'd realized that he was actually going to do something. And like, I kind of go through the scenarios and it's like, let's say I thought he was going to do this and I told my parents, the likelihood is that they wouldn't believe me and that he, you know, would not get in trouble. I would get in trouble for trying to cause trouble. And, you know, maybe he would then proceed with his plan and kill me too. Or maybe he would wait and would have acted out differently down the road. And it's just kind of one of those things where, you know, you try to figure out what you could have done, and the guilt is what drives you to do that.
Who took care of you after your brother murdered your parents and your sister?
For the first few months, it was the neighbors that I had gone to that night, who had a daughter my age that I went to school with. And, you know, right after it happened, we weren't quite sure what to do or what I was supposed to do or anything like that. And we were very poor. And so they took me to the local, and they were poor as well, I should say. And they took me to the local legal aid office. And we met with the executive director there who saw in me this, you know, salvageable person amidst, you know, all of the other things that have gone on. And he took a real interest in my life and what was happening and making sure that I kind of got through all of the hurdles in front of me there immediately. There was also a wonderful woman, Connie Skillman, who worked for the National Victims Assistance Organization. And she was just really wonderful as well in making sure that getting through the legal system and all the things that I needed to do was made as painless as possible. And I truly wish that there were more organizations like that or more people within the justice system that can help victims navigate the process.
Who became your legal guardians?
Thad Geyer, who was the executive director of the legal aid office.
It's kind of amazing that he would take you in like that.
There were a lot of people in the community who offered to take me in, and it was amazing. And you know, and there were a few other people that Connie Skillman also offered to take me in, and a couple of other people there. And And I basically chose to stay with that because he was really focused on building my self-esteem and helping me do all the things that I needed to do to succeed in life. And so that's what I did.
Did you have any extended family, uncles, aunts, cousins?
I did. I had, you know, we had relatives, but part of the you know, the family sickness in our that we had was kind of isolation. And my parents tended to denigrate all of the grandparents and cousins and everyone on both sides of the family before, during, and after, you know, kind of annual visits. So, you know, at the time, so when they died, kind of the thought of like, I didn't really have an image of my grandparents as these kindly old people. They were just like these people who didn't help my parents out and who were, you know, lived far away. And for me, I didn't want to go in and be with them. I wanted to stay in my same town and be near the things that I knew.
Jody Arlington will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Dial Press, publisher of Temple Stream, A Rural Odyssey, a nonfiction narrative that explores the Maine countryside, by Bill Rohrbach. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Jody Arlington about her life after her brother murdered their parents and little sister. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reviews a new book about the history of gospel music. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jody Arlington. 21 years ago, when she was 16, her 18-year-old brother killed their parents and younger sister. But he spared Jody Arlington. She never discussed the story with anyone, aside from people she knew well, until last June, when she wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post after reading about a similar set of murders. She hoped to shed some light on the warning signs that her family missed and explain what it's like to be the survivor. Was it frightening after the murders? I mean, did you think that other people who you knew could turn on you or turn against you or other people that you love and commit murder after having seen your brother do just that?
Not really. I mean, you know, when you experience something like I did, you kind of lose all your faith and trust in humanity. and can feel that basically anyone is capable of doing anything in the right circumstances. And that's kind of the way that I feel about it now. So I wasn't like actually in fear that something terrible was going to happen to me or people that I knew or that something like that would happen. But, you know, I did develop a great interest in understanding human nature and understanding what causes people to do terrible things and what the stressors are. And I became very interested in college in, you know, Holocaust literature and Dostoevsky and all of those, you know, places where people have explored, you know, man's inhumanity to man and why it happens.
How did that help you?
It helped me enormously. It gave me a nomenclature or a way to find people who had experienced. I mean, I would never in a million years compare my experience to anyone who suffered in the Holocaust, but losing everything and having like a complete family annihilation and just kind of like all of the scholars who have studied like why this happens, it was a way for me to figure to apply that to my own case as much as it was applicable, and it helped me a lot. And also it's like, you know, they talk about, you know, the vision of the void and seeing the worst, and you know, what do you turn away or do you look into it? And also they talk a lot about bearing witness, and it's like, do you talk about what happened to you or do you just keep quiet about it? And you know, I've always felt that I should bear witness about what happened in my own family, and it's part of the reason that I wasn't compelled to write the article and why I'm talking to you now is to somehow give some meaning to what happened by hopefully allowing it to, you know, elucidate the issue of parricide and why it happens and what people have to deal with when it happens.
What was the media coverage of your case like? You know, stories like this where one person in a family murders the rest of the family can become a really big media story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's obviously very dramatic. What was the media coverage like, and what was the effect on you?
I was one of those very fortunate people who was completely shielded from the media. I was not listening to the radio or watching TV or reading newspapers, you know, during the time that it immediately following the murders. And, you know, I don't know if it was because of my age or just that it was before the 24/7 news cycle. There wasn't that same type of mania to try to, you know, get access to me or this. And I always feel incredibly sorry for those people who are kind of caught, you know, in the situation where they're like at their most weakest and vulnerable moment and they're being hounded by the media or their grief is being displayed for all to see. And I just feel like that's re-victimizing a victim. So I fortunately did not have to deal with that. I think one of the reasons that there was so little interest in our case additionally to that is that there were like three or four other cases in Oregon that year of parricide. And, you know, in fact, you know, studies have shown, and I've obviously read about this, is that there are like 300 cases of parricide every year. And you know, only one or two of them will have that right component of salaciousness to like really get a lot of attention.
Did part of you wish you could like leave town and start fresh with a brand new name in another place where no one would have known about this? You were 16 when it happened.
Well, you know, it you feel completely alienated and like an alien. You know, you just don't even feel part of the human race after something like this happens. And there's so much shame and fear associated with anyone who endures something like this. And so, you know, it was terribly painful when, you know, someone would see your name and say, oh, you're that Jody Gilley girl, and just have so many questions about why did it happen, and you know, why is it that you're able to walk around, and you know, just kind of all sorts of uncomfortable moments. And you know, and we had two different junior high schools that fed into one high school, and I did change my last name at that time so that at least 50%, of the student body would not immediately know who I was or associate me with what had happened to me. What I found, and I did, move away after high school, and came to Washington and have lived in Spain for a couple of years, in New York for a couple of years. But what I discovered, and what I think is probably true for most people who endure these kind of things, is that with every year that goes by, that you kind of are judged on your actions and your behavior and your accomplishments, what happened to you becomes this less intense thing, or this a smaller piece of you. And that's what I found. I had to do a lot of arduous work, dealing with what happened and why it happened and figuring it out and addressing my own behavioral problems and all of that, and eventually became what I am now, which is, I think, a fairly normal functioning adult.
My guest is Jody Arlington. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jody Arlington. 21 years ago, her 18-year-old brother killed their parents and younger sister. We're talking about the murders and what her life has been like since then. After your brother killed your parents and sister with a baseball bat, when he came in to talk to you, one of the things he said to you was that he felt like the killer in the movie Friday the 13th, only it was messier than he thought it would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really interesting, that he would be thinking, comparing his own experience with what he'd seen in a horror movie.
Well, one of the ways that my mother had us spend our family time was she had a great interest and enjoyment in kind of the bloody cinema of the Friday the 13th movies and that sort of, any of those thrasher thrill movies, which I could never stand. I hated them. Yeah, I think it does speak to, I think it speaks to young people not really knowing the difference between reality and the imaginary when they're growing up. I think in a lot of these cases where you'll have like really young kids do really terrible things, I think they just don't even have like the judgment capacity developed yet in their brains to know what the consequences of their actions are. I don't think that Billy didn't know what he was doing. He was 18, but I think that he had not thought through the consequences of what he was doing.
I'm going to ask you something that I feel really uncomfortable asking, and probably not nearly as uncomfortable as you'll feel answering it if you choose to. But you know how your brother said to you, "Now we're free," after he killed your parents?
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a part of you that felt, in some like really horrible way, free of them? I mean, because they had psychologically abused you and they had physically abused him, and it was a really difficult family life.
The reality was that I was free of them, but that was never really a sense of comfort in any way. It was always a source of pain that, I did not get to grow up and see if maybe things might have changed had they lived. I had not had the opportunity to kind of, because things are just, everything is like so important and kind of skewed when you're a teenager. And what if, the economy would have turned around, or, there are like a whole host of things that could have happened and maybe things would have changed. And those, that's what I think about sometimes. I never feel, I get little comfort from that thought. Let me put it that way.
We're supposed to not speak ill of the dead. We're certainly not supposed to speak ill of our parents or our family. Is it hard to speak honestly about your family, Your brother murdered your parents and sister. Your parents physically abused your brother. You say they psychologically abused you. And, you know, a larger good is often served by telling the truth, but it's a hard thing to do.
Yes, and, you know, when I was growing up and kind of closer to the abuse, I felt, you know, I could talk about it and even remember it more, and had a lot of resentments and anger and things like that that I worked through, and kind of coming to, I mean, when you try to understand what causes other people to behave the way they do, a compassion kind of forms for it, or at least an understanding. And so you are less, I'm less inclined to, you know, I don't want to speak poorly of my family. I feel very sad for them, and I don't want to speak poorly about Billy, but at the same time, you know, I fear him. So I wish that I could speak more specifically and detailed about, you know, the kind of abuse that happened in the family and describe that in a more detailed way. But I feel like it, for me now, that doesn't serve as great a good as actually talking about the things that we can do about it to prevent similar things happening.
Do you think your understanding of what happened in your family when you were 16, when those events actually happened, is different than your understanding now as a 37-year-old?
Absolutely. It evolved continuously as I grew up and kind of went through the different stages of development that one does. My high school understanding compared to my, you know, college understanding when I first started kind of dealing with what happened to us to kind of my understanding now that I'm the same age as my mother was when she died. It's completely, you know, evolved, and I imagine that it will continue to evolve.
And look, what's one example of the differences between how you understood it at the age of 16 when it happened and how you understand it now?
When I was 16, I couldn't understand why, you know, our parents would do things to hurt us, or that why they needed to control us and not allow us to kind of our own personhoods, that we were, you know, essentially just their belongings and needed to do exactly what they said when they said it. And if we didn't, there would be terrible consequences. And, you know, when I got older and kind of understood the economic strain, the kind of that they were behaving the same way that they were, you know, treated when they were growing up, when I, you know, I understood kind of that my mother just was so fearful of the family falling apart that she, you know, did everything she did to try to preserve it, which was, you know, twisted and wrong. But I mean, I understood what was impacting them to make them behave that way. And it's kind of like in any other situation where a situation escalates and escalates and escalates if no one kind of steps in and fixes it, and there was just no one, no entity, no idea, nothing that kind of intervened to kind of stop the escalation of the family, which ultimately self-destructed.
Would you like to start a family of your own, and how has, you know, the horror and tragedy of your own family experience affected how you see yourself as you know, as a wife or as a mother?
Right. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because, you know, my brother's violent act was not the only thing in our family tree that had gone on. My mother's mother had, like, shot and killed my grandfather in an act of passion when my mother was an infant. And my father's father, you know, served in World War II and helped liberate Paris and kind of came back an alcoholic and was very abusive and you know, ended up getting murdered. And actually the grandmother who had killed my mom's dad was actually murdered in a robbery in San Francisco. So it was really kind of like this multi, and then of course there were other, you know, black sheep as well. And, you know, there's kind of this, you know, I used to joke darkly that, you know, violent death runs in my family. And, you know, I did kind of decide early on that, you know, do I really want to take a chance on my genes and you know, and do this? And so my feelings have always kind of been that there are so many kids that need, you know, need loving parents. And that if I ever feel that I want to become a parent, which currently I'm not leaning towards that, that, you know, I would adopt. And that way it takes that whole component completely out of the picture, because I was concerned that even if there wasn't a genetic defect, as it were, that I would be so worried about that, that, you know, that I might cause some sort of problem. But fortunately, I found a wonderful man who feels the same way I do about adoption, and it's, we'll see what happens.
You'll excuse me for saying, wow, what a family history. I mean, that's so scary. I mean, do you ever think, like, what genes are in me? I mean, like, what, you know?
You know, I am a big believer in nurture over nature.
Uh-huh.
And that, in, you know, and again, that even the most well-bred and genetically pure person can do really terrible things in the right circumstances, and people who come from backgrounds such as my own can do very great things and be very normal with the right input and nurturing and you know, guidance. So, you know, when I was younger and worried about these things much more, I was terrified of my genes, and now, you know, I'm not. Just because I know how I live my life and how I behave and interact with people, and that, you know, that's not really an issue for me at this point.
When you hear people kind of celebrate family as being like the most profound and most important and most wonderful and thing in life, and as being implicitly good and implicitly mm-hmm. loving and important and all of that, what do you think about? I mean, I know what happened in your family is exceptional, but it's hardly the only family where, not only where murder is committed, but it's hardly the only family in which people have...
Right.
Have
Terry,
yeah.
Every day, you know, I do not feel sorry for myself for what happened, because we had an abusive and terrible family, but through this terrible act, I was, you know, freed from that. And I think about all of the kids and women in relationships that are being abused and starved or, you know, beaten. And I'm just constantly reminded that I was one of the lucky ones. So that is part of it. Additionally, you know, I have amazing found family. And, you know, as I was growing up and seeing how my friends dealt with, you know, the issues in their own families, you know, and sometimes I felt lucky that I didn't have to deal with some of the same issues. And other times I just felt incredibly sad that I didn't have, you know, that person who, you know, by birth and blood was going to always be there for me. But then I have this found family that absolutely is there for me. And I think that that's what a lot of people do when they have really bad family situations.
Jodi Arlington, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jodi Arlington is a former vice president of the public relations firm Fleischman Hilliard and former chief of staff for President Clinton's national campaign against youth violence. She's now a communications consultant in the arts. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward reviews a new book on the history of gospel music. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Gospel music is the big missing link in most discussions of American post-war popular music. It's the least reissued, least listened to late 20th century form these days. And our rock critic Ed Ward says that's a shame. Despite its influence on soul music and today's R&B, not to mention its inherent drama and power, and its message of hope to oppressed people, relatively little has been written about it. Ed read a new history of gospel called People Get Ready by Robert Darden, and he has this review.
I'm too close to my journey's end. I'm too close to turn back into a world of sin. And I wouldn't take nothing for my journey right now. Lord, you know I've just gotta make it to heaven somehow. I'm too close.
I know rock fans give lip service to gospel music, but I don't know many who've actually heard much of it. Since it's hard to figure out where to start with gospel music, I was quite happy to see an ad for a book called People Get Ready, A New History of Black Gospel Music, written by Robert Darden and published by Continuum. It looks scholarly, and Darden was identified as a professor at Baylor University and gospel editor of Billboard, so I got a copy. It's a remarkable book, all right. Darden's really done his homework, and of the book's 425 pages, the last 100 are taken up by 78 pages of footnoted references in the index. He's made some significant discoveries and made some really brilliant connections. But the question remains, is this a place to start learning about gospel? Professor Darden's at his best in the book's first half, where he charts the growth of African-American Christian sacred music from its very beginnings. Do we really need to know about African liturgical dance in order to understand the sensational nightingales? Well, yes, in a way, we do. These dances evolved into what were called ring shouts, which were practiced during and after slavery, and were condemned by church leaders in the 1920s and 30s as being backwards and unseemly. Yet the physical reactions in the congregations that the newer music these preachers preferred were, arguably, the same thing, expressed differently. Darden obsesses about the nature of African music, the African tribes who were enslaved, and their practices, because he wants to establish that there were survivals even after the generations who remembered Africa firsthand had died off. And he does, as far as I'm concerned. He then investigates the spiritual, just what it was and what it sounded like, although he concedes there's no exact way to tell. He brilliantly establishes connections between spirituals and the slave underground, particularly the Underground Railroad and Harriet Tubman, who is known to many as Moses. And from there, he considers the relationship between the minstrel show and the groups of Jubilee singers who emerged after the Civil War, giving Americans and Europeans their first hearing of authentic, or semi-authentic anyway, African-American music. All of this takes us up to the start of the 20th century, and so far, so good. When the commercial gospel scene appears, the industry of selling hymn books and writing music, especially for the African-American churches, Darden charts it well, in his synopsis of the emergence of the first really important gospel figure, Thomas A. Dorsey, is excellent. Dorsey's important because he basically invented gospel music as we know it today, aggressively promoting his compositions and creating a body of work that includes songs many people think are folk songs, they're so familiar.
I'm tired and weary, but I'm the Lord comes to call me away. Oh Lord, where the morning is bright and the lamb
By providing a repertoire on which the next generation of gospel performers could build, Dorsey opened the gates to a flood of groups and soloists who added a showbiz element to the church's music. One of his early protégés was Mahalia Jackson, who influenced James Cleveland, who played piano for the Caravans, most of whom became successful solo performers, and was friends with Reverend C.L. Franklin, whose daughter Aretha, well, you know about her. But it's just at this period, when names people today would recognize start to appear, that Darden falters. As soon as the 1950s begin, the narrative begins to lose focus. At this point, I began to hanker for another book. The Gospel Sound, by Anthony Heilbutt, seems to raise Professor Darden's hackles, although he quotes numerous interviews Heilbutt has done. But Heilbutt is still in print, as far as I know, and it could be that his take on gospel is a more lively one for people coming to the music from rock and roll. Heilbutt goes into the personalities and some of the sociology of gospel, noting, for instance, that the black church is a refuge for nonconformists, including sexual ones. I found it very odd that Darden discussed two major post-war gospel figures, both gay, one flamboyantly so, without mentioning this aspect. Weirdly, he also barely mentions the great hit song by the Impressions, After Which People Get Ready, is named. Sometime during what he calls the Golden Age of Gospel, Darden runs out of steam and the book turns into a dull recitation of names. Fortunately, as I said, Heilbutt's still in print, so if you're interested in post-war gospel, I'd start there and then pick up Darden for the background. Of course, there's still one problem. The vast majority of the music of gospel's golden age remains out of print. How about some smart record company doing for gospel what Rhino did for doo-wop 12 years ago with its magnificent doo-wop box? I think they'd be surprised at the reaction.
Ed Ward reviewed People Get Ready by Robert Darden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
He didn't have to do it, buddy. Thank you, Jesus.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that more students graduate from high school ready for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jim Jarmusch talks about writing and directing his new film Broken Flowers, which stars Bill Murray. The Independent Film Channel is premiering a new animated series that satirizes the indie film world. We'll talk with Bob Balaban, the series writer, director, and co-star, and Jonathan Katz, who does the voice of the therapist. Join us for the next Fresh Air.